I think I found probably the thing that I'll tease Zach the most about is how young he is. I could tell how young you are by your story. If you'd have grown up when I did, if I was 2 years old and I jumped in a pool in front of my dad, it would have went, and I remember my dad jumping in and pulling me out and beating the living snot out of me. I'm glad you grow up in a kinder, gentler era, man. Have you ever considered the terms, that you will, the terms of endearment that the Bible gives us as God's children? We're called creatures because he is the creator and we were created, so we're called creatures. We're called children. You'll find that many, many times. Jesus says that we're his sheep. I'm not so sure how to take that. When you spend a little time with sheep, you'll find out they're not the brightest of animals, but yet Jesus calls us his sheep. But what about aroma? Have you ever considered that you are called a smell? That you smell like something? That you smell like who? Like Jesus. 2 Corinthians 2:15, it says, we are the aroma of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. Being in Christ means you smell like him. So that when God gets around us, he doesn't smell necessarily us, he smells Jesus. We are an aroma, and we're an aroma to everybody who are around. Our scripture reading said that when his people are brought out of the captivity, Ezekiel speaks and tells the people that are in captivity, when his people are brought out, they will be accepted as a pleasing what? As a pleasing aroma. Now think about that application. What do you have to do to welcome an aroma? It just happens, doesn't it? Think of your favorite smell. It just happens. As a matter of fact, sometimes with our favorite smells, we'll go looking for them, won't we? We'll go looking for them. When I was little, one of my favorite smells, I don't know why, one of my favorite smells was rubber, especially car tires. There was this little general store that was down the street from my grandmother's house, and it was in between the grocery store that she used to go to. And I'd walk with her, and I'd go into that store, and they sold tires for some reason. I don't know, this dinky little store in Bisbee. Building's still there, by the way. And they had this entire rack of car tires. So the entire place smelled like tires. One of my favorite smells was tires, you know. I'll walk around Les Schwab, and I don't even need tires. I'll just standing back there going. Yeah. But we'll go looking for our most pleasing odors. We don't have to do anything. And God is saying that you are as welcome to him as a pleasing odor, if you will, an aroma, your favorite smell. You don't have to. Again, it just happens. It's a wonderful application, a wonderful application. Now, in our series on the covenant, I have to tell you that pleasant fragrances have quite a connection in the covenant itself, especially as we move from the covenant given to Adam to now the covenant given to Noah. Look how he describes it. Noah built an altar. This is after the flood. Okay, so this is after the flood when God promises that Noah will be the carrier of the covenant. And it says, Noah built an altar to the Lord. He took of every clean animal, every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the Lord. And when the Lord smelled the what? The pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, for the inclination of the human heart is only evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living creature. He did that after doing what? After smelling something. That must have been quite an aroma. That's quite a smell for God himself to say in his heart. In other words, it got to him in his heart. And if you think about it, that's what our most favorite smells do. Because our favorite smells are our favorite smells, probably because they remind you of something or someone. So they go right to the heart. The Lord said in his heart. So remember where we have been. The covenant made with Adam simply is that the creator of all life, the creator of life in this universe, creates children that he can love because he's decided that he is going to rule and govern his universe by the principle of love. He's not just a loving God, he is love. So he decided that he was going to become love. He used his free will because that's what he has inherently as God. He can be whoever and whatever he wants to be, but he chose, and he chose that he was going to be love. That's how he was going to operate his universe. So when he created his children, he created them in his image. The ability to choose, to have free will. Because anything short of free will is not love. He won't force us to worship. He won't make us afraid of him to worship. He won't coerce us to worship. It comes from our free will. We choose to love. So the covenant was, I create in my image, and you get to what? You get to live. The life giver, that's his part of the covenant. The covenant maker, that's his part of the covenant. You and I, live. That's all he told them to do, live. But live in a specific way. Live in the only way that you can live, and that is to have a living, breathing, walking, talking relationship with the one who gives them life. Every day he showed up in the garden simply to walk with them and to talk with them. And by the way, that is the fulfillment of all the covenant. Every time that we study the covenant, every time that we will go to the next person who will carry the covenant on, the ultimate end, the ultimate goal of the covenant is that they walk with him and talk with him. And these men that carry this out, these men and women that carry this covenant out, what he's trying to show them is that the relationship that he has with them is the relationship that he would like to have with everybody. So Noah is the next one to bring it on. But what happened was that we decided to break the covenant. We decided to not walk in the covenant anymore. And rather than choose life, we used our created ability, if you will, of free will, and we chose death. We chose another way to walk. And now what's happened is that now the creatures that were meant to walk and talk with him now don't even want to be in his presence. As a matter of fact, they run from his presence. They have a new nature about them. Their nature is no longer about love, it's about self. Well, it's still about love, but it's about the love of self, which really is the opposite of love. But he tells them that he'll keep the covenant because he showed them right there in the garden. A lamb dies for their death. He clothes them with their skins and then promises them that someday, this will all come to an end. And someday, because of a particular lamb that will come, of a particular child that will come from Eve, we'll all get to live again. And we all get to walk and to talk with him. So by Genesis 8, not only do human beings, have they broken the covenant, they set about to destroy it all. Within one generation, we have the first murder. And not only is it a murder, it's two brothers. And as far as we know, it might still be the only two living people outside their parents that are on the planet. That means one-fourth. The very first murder took away one-fourth of the planet's population. And then within 10 generations, according to chapter 6, verse 5, it is only evil continually. By 10 generations, they're about ready to destroy it all. Now, God's solution, part and parcel of the covenant with Noah, was a desperate one, a flood, a worldwide catastrophic flood. It's a tough subject. I spent a couple of weeks talking about the flood. Because I don't like how God has been portrayed and the reasons for bringing the flood about. So hopefully now, after we took a little detour talking about the flood, that we can see the flood as part of the covenant of life, not the covenant of death. Because actually what was happening was that those people weren't really living anymore. They were in the active daily process of cannibalizing each other up to the extinction of the human race. Their covenant wasn't about life, it was about death. The flood, which buys time for life to exist and to flourish again, that brings about life. Hopefully we can see The flood is nothing but an act of mercy. It's a desperate act of mercy. And on the surface, it does not appear to be an act of mercy. But I guarantee you, if it wasn't for the flood, none of us would be here. None of us would be here. And I'm not so sure about the verdict of the great controversy either. Creation's down to 8 heartbeats. 3, 5. 8 heartbeats. 3, 5. So God searches for a place. To me, God's always looking for a place on this planet that's all about death. He's looking for a place, just this one spot where life can happen. And it happens in the heart of somebody who chooses to live. So he searched and he searched and he found this one heart. What's his name? His name's Noah. Noah found favor in the sight of the Lord. These are the descendants of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah what? Walked with God. He found his man. Ever since Adam and Eve walked away from him, he's been looking for someone to walk with him. Because that's what they were created to do. Noah found one place. He finds his heart. He finds his man. There he is. By the way, why is Noah blameless in his generation? Why is he a righteous man? Because he walks with God. He walks with God. Doesn't mean he was perfect. Just means he decided he was going to make the decision. God says, that's the guy. He's the guy. He's going to carry the covenant. Somebody who would simply have this relationship. A human that will turn around and say, you know what? I'll give it a shot. I'll walk with you. I'll talk with you. And God says, yes. Here he is. So out of all of mankind, there is his love. There is his opportunity for life. Out of all of mankind, out of all the people living on the planet, it exists in this one heartbeat and the 7 that go with him, his sons, their wives, and his wife. This is it right here. All of mankind. It is down to 8 heartbeats. And God did describe it. The earth was corrupt in God's sight. The earth was filled with violence. God saw that the earth was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted its ways upon the earth. Violence is now the way that it operates. No longer operating by love, it's now operating by violence. And we talked about that in our 2 series. That is what evolution is about. Evolution is about forcing nature to become what it's going to be. Evolution, this loveless process that most of the planet believes gives life, when actually it's death. Filled with violence. I don't know why it's so hard for us to imagine what a planet completely engulfed by violence is really like. In 1914, Franz Ferdinand, who was the nephew of the Austro-Hungarian emperor and also heir to his throne, was killed by a terrorist group known as the Black Hand. And because they were a Serbian nationalist society, the empire declared war on Serbia. Then Russia, who was bound by a treaty, had to mobilize, which meant that Germany had to declare war on Russia. France then had to declare war on Germany. And 4 years, 3 months, and 2 weeks later, World War I ends to the tune of anywhere between 8.5 to 11 million military dead. 4.5 to 8.5 million civilian dead, and 24 million wounded. Making World War I one of the most, if not the most, costly human conflicts in all of human history. And it begins with the assassination of one nephew. I don't know why we have such a hard time picturing why the flood was necessary. I don't know why we have such a hard time picturing of what it would really take for God to have to buy time. We have to have that faith that Zach was talking about, although it looks bad at times, and although it does not look like love, and that sometimes we are tempted to believe the enemy's propaganda about God and why he brought the flood about. But all I do is that every time I look at human history, every time I think of the future that is in front of us, I look at the flood as an act of mercy. And ask anybody who's ever fought in a human war what kind of mercy they would welcome at any given time. So God comes to his friend. It's his friend. How do I know? Because the way he says it, God said to Noah, I've determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence. Because of them, I'm going to destroy them along with the earth. How do I know that Noah was God's friend? Noah, God gets his plans. He tells his plans to his friends. This is what I'm about. He didn't have to. And again, the picture of the God, of the creator of all the universe, walking with this one human being, having this conversation with this one human being, and deciding that he's going to take this one human being and tell him his plan. What human God does that? What human God does that? Make yourself an ark of cypress wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and out with pitch. Not only does he tell Noah his plan, he makes Noah part of his plan. We're in this together, he said. You and me, we're in this together. I got a part to play, you got a part to play. There's a human element. By the way, there's always a human element in the plan of salvation. He's called the Son of Man for a reason. Is that God not only wants to create, he not only wants to be what he has called himself to be, but also he wants to be in it. He wants to experience it. It's not just that he has children. It's not just that he creates us and then goes and spends time somewhere else creating other places in the universe. No, he created us to walk and to talk with. So there's an element always, the human element is that he's willing to experience it with us. To walk and to talk. So with Noah, it's you know, he's saying, and every time that somebody will stand up and say, you know what, God, I'll walk with you, so that he can come and he can make his covenant with him, there's this element that person has something to do with God's love in the world just by experiencing this relationship. Noah becomes a Messiah-like figure because of Noah's work. Humanity could have the opportunity to be saved. He says, though, I'm going to bring flood waters on the earth to destroy life. Every creature that's breath of life, everything on earth will perish. But I will establish my covenant with you. What's amazing is that before it even happens, he wants Noah to understand that the covenant is his. And it's his when? Now, flood's coming, but my covenant is with you. It was like, remember the conversation that he had with Adam and Eve? Before the terror or the horror of the new creation begins to operate, he wants them to know that salvation's coming. He tells Noah that too. Before this happens, I want you to know the covenant will be yours. You're going to experience this flood. You're going to go through this. It will not be easy. It will be horrifying. But I want you to know the covenant is coming. And not only is the covenant coming, the covenant is here. He just wanted them to remember this first. And then the description. The water swelled so mightily on the earth that the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The water swelled above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep, 45 feet above the highest mountain. We always say that. We always say 45 feet above Everest. Everest didn't exist till after the flood. So I don't know how high the mountains were back then. I'm not sure that they were really that high at all. But he's trying to give everyone an idea. Is there any place on the earth that is not covered by water? No. That's what he's saying. Anywhere on earth is not covered by water. Nellie and I, our first church was up in Humboldt County. And in 1964, there was a flood in Humboldt County that nearly wiped out all of southern Humboldt's towns. The Eel River flooded to the point to where there was a town there that is no longer on the map. You see a sign for it, but the town isn't there. It hasn't been there since 1964. It was washed completely off. And these people who were in their 30s and 40s, then in 64, by the time that when we got there and we meet them, I guarantee you, the first subject out of their mouth about living there is the 1964 flood. You talk to anybody who was there, it's, hi, nice to meet you. Let me tell you about 1964. They're still talking about it. Everything on land whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, human beings and animals, creeping things and birds of the air. They're blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those were with him in the ark. And the water swelled in the earth for 150 days. I picture earth up until this point of what God created it to be as an incubator for life. Out of all the universe, and even before he started, in Genesis, before he begins the creation, it says that the earth was without form and in void. There is no life there. There's nothing there. So he creates this little incubator, this little dirty tennis ball of a planet that has everything required in it for life. And what happened after the fall was that they literally unplugged the incubator. So God literally has to start completely over again. And he takes one of the two elements that is absolutely required for anybody to survive. He takes water and he uses the water to take it apart again, and then allows the water to recede. And pretty soon after the water recedes, what begins to come back? Life begins to come back. God found room. He bought us time. Because the Messiah doesn't come until the fullness of time has been reached. And the fullness of time wasn't even going to be reached near what it was going to be. The fullness of time had been short-circuited. The incubator had been unplugged. By the way, Jesus says it will be the same in the end, that there's a trouble coming that has never been seen and will never be seen again. And he says something about the time of the end that was so true in the flood, that if God does not cut this short, no one will be saved. Evolution's time. Sin's time. Sin's rule. Evolution's rule on the planet. If God does not cut it short, not even those of us sitting here would be saved. Jesus said, as in the days of Noah, so will the days of mine be. The people in Noah's day were saved by his mercy, and the people in Jesus' day will be saved by his mercy. Not because any of us could recognize the signs of the time. Even the people that recognize the signs of the times, they'll be lost if God does not cut this short. That's why he told them, on the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. There's nothing we could do about this. Death will reign unless God does something about it. He did something about it in Noah's day, and he's done something about it in Jesus' day by offering his salvation. Jesus becomes our ark. And we're free to walk on. Except God remembered Noah and all the wild animals, all the domestic animals that were with him in the ark. God made a wind blow over the earth and the water subsided. He remembered Noah. We have to remember that the ark did not save Noah. Sometimes we think, wow, he was in a boat and he got to float, you know. That ark was a matchbox. That ark might as well have been made of cardboard compared to a worldwide catastrophic flood. The ark did not save Noah. God remembered Noah, and that saved him. God saved his friend, because he promised him he would. God said, I'm about to recreate this place, and you, my friend, are going to be the one that's going to carry my covenant. And how do we know? Because God smelled it. Noah smelled like a friend. Back in the verse that I shared with you. He gets off the ark, he builds an altar, and he makes a sacrifice on that altar. And God smelled that smell. And when he did, he smelled his friend. Again, how powerful is smell? One of my favorite smells, watermelon bubblegum. Every now and then I'll buy some watermelon bubblegum because sometimes in my advanced age, I like to remember when I was playing Little League Baseball. And nothing takes me back to remembering playing Little League Baseball than watermelon bubblegum. How many of you remember Bub's Daddy? Oh, you're good little Adventist boys. You were never allowed to eat Bub's Daddy. It had sugar in it. But not only were we allowed to eat it, it came like by the pound. It was like this big. It went from, it was this long. And we'd take it and we'd fold it up into quarters and put it in the back pocket of our uniform, which was flannel, by the way. Yeah, I played Little League with Babe Ruth, you know. But I smell watermelon bubblegum, and I can remember names that I can't remember otherwise. And I can remember that I used to actually be able to play baseball before I got old. How many of you just go into the mall and like to walk by Cinnabon? I'm not going to ask you if you stop and eat there. Just if you could walk by there, right? And as soon as I said the word Cinnabon, I saw people smile. Why? Because you're smelling it, aren't you? You're not tasting it. You're smelling it. We back in the day in radiology, anybody here ever had an upper GI exam? Isn't the upper GI exam just horrible? Nothing to eat or drink after midnight. Your stomach is completely empty. And if you're used to eating breakfast every day, that's the patients that I would get. They haven't eaten or drinking, ate or drank anything, and they come in, and we take this heavy, heavy cup of barium and say, here, drink. Feast on the breakfast that we offer you today at the restaurant of the radiology department. And in order for a radiologist to take pictures of what he needs to see, the barium's got to move. And when people are hungry and you dump in this heavy, chalky liquid, it doesn't move. It just sits there. So my favorite radiologist, the way that he got them, by the way, what is everybody, even if they don't eat breakfast, usually most of my patients, what are they missing the most sitting there at 8 o'clock in the morning? They're missing their coffee, that's right. Missing their coffee. Now, I don't know, I don't care how you feel about coffee. It smells pretty good. But the radiologist, what he used to do is they'd be standing there and he'd be looking under the fluoroscope and it's not moving, it's just sitting there. And he needs it to move, he needs it to go beyond. So he would ask me to give him his coffee. And I'd hand the doctor his coffee and he would take it and he would just run it under the nose of the patient. And as soon as he did that, he would hit the fluoro and you'd look on the fluoro and it would just open up and move. All they had to do was smell it. See, I wonder about God. I know he knew. I know he knows. He knows the beginning from the end. He knew exactly what was going to happen long before he ever created this planet. He knew about the flood. He knew about all of those things. But there's an element to the covenant where it says that he's not satisfied with that knowledge. Are you understanding what I'm saying? Just because he knows does not mean that he would stop and prevent, especially if it infringes upon free will. And I know I'm trying not to get philosophical, but what I'm saying is that the knowledge that he has is not enough for him. He's decided that he's going to experience it. So I don't think he was sitting on his throne during the flood. I think in the presence of his Holy Spirit, he was with Noah on the ark because he promised him that he would save him. So he experienced it. And so he decides in all of this talk about smell and everything else is that now he's in the kingdom and now he's trying to get across. How do I know that I still have my friend? Is it possible that Noah could have hardened his heart after he witnessed what he witnessed? Is it possible for him to get off the ark and say, you know what? You're too scary for me to follow you. This is way too much for me. after what he saw after 150 days. Maybe watching God's creation being taken apart was too much for him. And that's what God is saying, is that he placed himself in that fuzzy area that creatures have a hard time understanding. And then he decides to experience finding out whether or not Noah is still his friend by waiting for the smell. And he's saying that up until the point to where Noah makes the sacrifice, even though he knows that Noah is going to carry out the covenant, he decides not to experience the joy of Noah's decision until Noah makes the decision. And Noah made the sacrifice, and it said that it pleased God. That's my friend. I don't know what it smells like when an entire ocean decides to recede away. I imagine it didn't smell very good after a while. Seaweed, kelp. Until everything adjusts again, everything starts, you know. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of all of that decay, maybe, if you will, there's this smell that cuts through. Sacrifice once again. The innocent dies for the guilty. This is what's soothing to God. This is what pleases him. It's not that he likes a barbecue, although barbecues smell pretty good, don't they? It's not that. It's when one of his creatures decides to accept life from the Creator, become his friend, to accept him giving him the covenant. And he decides he's going to experience it, even though he knew before the beginning of time that Noah was going to carry it. He decides to experience it with him. And the way that he describes that to us is that when he smelled the smell, he knew everything was okay. And at that moment, then, he vows in his heart to never do it again. To never, ever do it again. The covenant with Noah, adding now to the covenant of Adam, covenant of Noah now says, be fruitful, multiply. So he reiterates what he gave Adam and Eve. What's the first part of the covenant? I give life, you what? Live. Live, you live, your children live. I give you life. He's repeating the covenant with Adam. The fear and dread of you shall rest on every animal of the earth, on every bird of the air, on everything that creeps on the ground, all the fish of the sea into your hand. They are delivered. And why shouldn't nature be afraid of us now? It's a shame that he has to say that, but also what he's trying to get across to them is, you know what? Nature's going to be a pretty scary place too, because they figured it out. They figured out that you guys are in charge, and they figured out that you're out to get them because of your selfish natures now. So remember, we talked about that before. Those tigers now know what those teeth are for. They know what the claws are for. So he's trying to tell them, it's going to be a scary place, but don't worry, you're in charge. You're in charge. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your own lifeblood will surely require a reckoning from every animal. I will require it, and from human beings, each one for the blood of another. I will require a reckoning for human life. Whoever sheds the blood of a human, by a human that person's blood shall be shed. For in his own image, God made humankind. And you, be fruitful. And multiply, abound on the earth, and multiply in it. Before this covenant, death reigned. Before this covenant, death absolutely reigned. In fact, the punishment that God tried to give Cain said, I can't bear it. So God sends him away to his own land. And he lives now with this warning to everybody. If anybody tries to kill Cain, I will visit on him sevenfold. That was the curse of Cain. He carried that around with him. So Cain pretty much had free reign. He can do whatever he wants. You want to try to avenge Abel's death on me? God will bring death upon you sevenfold. So now it's official. Now it's part of the covenant. Now, it does seem that God is sort of giving in to the evolutionary nature, and that is, you kill, and we'll kill to punish. It's not what he's saying. What he's trying to give is he's trying to give the importance of life back into the creation. That life will be required of life. In other words, life will now reign supreme. We're the ones that chose that this would be about death. So now he's trying to get across to us a lesson in that life reckons life. In other words, murder has implications. And before this, it didn't. This is why the entire race was killing each other, is because there was no reckoning for it. So now there's reckoning for it. Life is of supreme importance again. But to me, the most important lesson that the covenant gives is that God decides to experience it. Look at these verses back here. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was what? And the Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it what? And it grieved him to his heart. Again, is it safe to know that God knows everything? It's safe to know that. Did he know what it was going to look like the minute that they fell? Yet, it's almost like that when it happens, he decides he is going to act. Is that he experiences it along with them. In other words, his knowledge isn't enough for him. He wants to experience it. So when it began to happen, it was almost like he was saying, you know what? It's almost like he was saying, I didn't realize it was going to be this bad. But now, since his children are experiencing it, he's now experiencing it. And now he has sorrow. And now he has grief. And that's what those words are saying. Because he gave the covenant a sign. What was the sign that he gave the covenant? This is the sign that I make between you and me and every living creature that is for you for all generations. I've set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember the covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. Did you notice that the covenant wasn't given for you and I to have a sign? The covenant was given so that he would see it. Now, I think it's very cool, because what do you think all these people are thinking, Noah's descendants, the next time it rains? So what happens after every rainstorm? A rainbow. So at least the people are reminded, hey, don't worry. I mean, I got to tell you, if I had lived through the flood, and a few days later, weeks, months, whenever the planet began needing water again, and it started to rain, I'd have to tell you, I'd start to think, wouldn't you? So wait a minute, we tore apart that ark quite a while ago. We needed the wood, okay? We tore it apart, and we don't have it now, and now it starts to rain. But I want you to notice that the rainbow wasn't so humanity would see and recognize and remember the covenant. It was so he would see it. The most beautiful thing about the covenant is that God decides he is going to experience it with us. See, again, he's God. Does he know? Of course he knows. Does he know what you're going to do for the rest of the day? He's known it since the beginning of time, right? So sometimes humans go, well, if he already knows, if he knows what I'm going to pray before I pray it, then why pray? Right? Why pray? Because God's decided that not only does he know what the prayer is, he's decided he places himself in a part of an experiencing father. I want to hear my children speak to me. And if he needs to be around his kids, it's because he's placed himself in that area of need. Love needs. He needs those in which he loves. And he says, you know what? When I see the rainbow, I will remember. He put it up there so that he could remember. He wanted to be reminded. He wants to experience what parents experience with loving children and vice versa. He's not satisfied with sitting on his throne and being God. He never has been. And the whole reason that the plan of salvation involves incarnation, the whole reason that the plan of salvation involves the Word becoming flesh and walking and talking among us is because it was never enough for him to sit on a throne and be God. What he always wanted was to be not just our Father, but to be our friend. To walk and to talk with us. The Noahic covenant brings about a few more things. It adds a few more things. But still, fundamentally, it's about life. And fundamentally, life only comes through this relationship that you and I get to choose with him and to walk with him face to face. Nothing in between. To walk with him and to talk with him. Noah's generations now get to experience that. Which includes who? How many here have descended from the descendants of Noah? What about the other half of you? Where did you come from? Really, literally. I mean, only half of you raised your hand. You know why? Because we're Seventh-day Adventists. Half is not bad for Adventists reacting in church, giving me an answer. You want to try again? How many have descended from the descendants of Noah? A little better. Okay, just one person. One alien over here. He raised his hand the first time. He didn't have to the second time. And to have the faith that Pastor Zach was talking about, that covenant made with our father Noah is ours today because of Jesus Christ. To walk with him and talk with him. God bless you all as you walk with him and talk with him this week. And we need to do it in trusting him, so why don't we sing about it? Number 524, how sweet it is to trust in Jesus.